Today, I'll be speaking with the incredibly popular mystery thriller writers, Preston and Child. Lincoln Child hails from Connecticut. Discovering a fascination for words, he made his way to New York in 1979, intent on finding a job in publishing. Lincoln was lucky enough to secure a position as an editorial assistant at St. Martin's Press. In 1987, Lincoln left trade publishing to work at MetLife. It was during these years that his own interest in writing returned. Within a few years, he left the company to write full-time. He now makes his home in New Jersey. Douglas Preston was born in Cambridge, Mass., and attended Pomona College in California. After graduating, Douglas began his career at the American Museum of Natural History in New York as an editor, writer, and finally manager of publications. He also taught nonfiction writing at Princeton and served as managing editor of Curator, a journal for museum professionals. His 8-year stint at the museum resulted in the nonfiction book Dinosaurs in the Attic, edited by a rising young star at St. Martin's Press, Lincoln Child. But today, I'll be speaking with the popular duo about Blue Labyrinth, number 15 in the Pendergast series. I would like to welcome Lincoln Child.
Hello, thank you for having us.
And Douglas Preston.
Hi, good to be here.
All right. For those who don't yet know him, can you introduce us to Pendergast?
Agent Pendergast of the FBI is probably the strangest FBI agent you ever want to meet or not want to meet. He's independently wealthy, he's suave, he's debonair, he's cold, he's distant, he wears black suits, he lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and he has a penchant for solving serial killings, which deviates almost into the obsessive. He loves it so much. And he's been our hero for almost 14 books now.
So which one of you is he modeled after?
Oh, well, he's modeled right after me. I'm exactly like Pendergast.
I guess so.
actually, he is really not like either one of us. Maybe he's like how we wish we were, but are not, a little bit. But he is pretty unique, and I'm not sure either one of us could explain where he came from. He just sort of arose in our minds and stepped out and shook our hands and said, I'm going to be your character from now on. And we said, fine.
Funny thing about him is that people seem to love him. You know, I mean, we've gotten a huge following, you know, of Pendergastians who just follow his every move and write stories about him and draw pictures about him. And there's just something about him that seems to appeal to a certain group of very discriminating and obviously intelligent and well-informed readers.
Exactly what I wanted to ask. Judging by the way you write, you've taken a decision to use a very high standard of vocabulary, and it makes me feel like you have a certain caliber of readers in mind. Is that true?
Well, yes. I mean, we have wonderful readers who are not afraid of once in a while running into a big word, and we don't write down to our readers at all. Our books have very intricate plots. We hope that our readers feel that they're well written. We love the English language, and we just love arcane, bizarre, and strange English words. And so, I mean, we're not going to tire the reader out with them, but it is true that there are, you know, a dozen or so really unusual words in each one of our books.
Right. Blue Labyrinth has a 100-year-old murder mystery at its core. What unique challenges did that present?
The challenge there was we wanted to write the book that would be like the capstone for all the Pendergast stories that had gone before. You know, I mean, he's, over his career, he's made enemies, he's made friends, he's saved lives, he's clearly ended lives as in his job, and we wanted to write a book that would sort of bring together this whole multifaceted universe and into one story and make it a huge, satisfying, basically, tale, and that involved bringing back some dark doings of Pendergast's own ancestors, which which would now revisit themselves upon him. So then in this story, instead of saving somebody else's life, Pendergast's job is basically to save his own before it's too late, and the clock is rapidly running out.
And this murder victim, by the way, is a skeleton that they find in the anthropology collections at the Museum of Natural History in New York, which is labeled as being a Hottentot skeleton from the early 19th century. But it turns out it's not. It's actually a Caucasian remains from a woman who was murdered in New York City in the 19th century, and the murder was hidden by hiding her skeleton in the museum's collection.
I wanted to ask you, museums figure prominently in your books. Why do you keep returning to this setting?
Well, I used to work in the Museum of Natural History in New York for many years, and Lincoln, actually the way we met was kind of curious. Lincoln contacted me. He was an editor at St. Martin's Press and wanted me to write a book about the museum, and I did. It was called Dinosaurs in the Attic. It was a nonfiction book, and I gave Lincoln a tour of the museum late at night, sort of a fun tour of storage rooms where people never go. We went to the dinosaur bone storage room, and we went to the whale, a collection of whale eyeballs and jars. I mean, there's so many weird collections there. And Lincoln turned to me and he said, "This is the scariest building in the world. We have got to write a thriller set in this building." And that became our novel, our first novel, The Relic, which was made into a movie by Paramount Pictures. It was a great success, a number one movie. And that's where we introduced Pendergast and got started. And that was almost 20 years ago.
I wanted to ask you about your process for collaboration and the actual writing of each chapter. How does that work?
Well, the way people assume that it works is that Doug writes chapter one, and I write chapter two, et cetera, et cetera. But that would be a recipe for disaster because it would be a mishmash. The way it actually works is that Doug and I brainstorm the idea for a new book and then we very carefully plot out an outline for 10 or 20 chapters. And then we assign each other arcs, for example, a character arc or a sequence of chapters involving one character or a particular dramatic sequence, so that we each are sort of champions of certain sections of the book, and then we trade off editing each other's prose, angering each other greatly in the process, and then we both take a chance to sort of do a literary zamboni over the whole thing at the end, so that we basically get to get all four hands on the book. So instead of what people might assume is a patchwork quilt of chapters, you know, that don't match up, you have a book that basically is more than some of its parts, because you have two people with their imaginations going full circle, you know, full out the whole time. And if Doug gets stuck on something, he can call me about it, and we can brainstorm it. And if I'm going in the wrong direction, he can straighten me out. So, you know, we both write solo books, so we know the story. We know the process, and writing together actually is more than the sum of its parts.
Well, the results are always amazing. We're speaking with Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child on The Book Report. Did you two imagine Chong Ron, or does it actually exist? Tell us about it.
Well, it exists, but not quite in that form. It's sort of a combination of the memory palace of Giordano Bruno, who is a Renaissance philosopher and mathematician, and who conceived of this idea that one could take create a memory palace, which is like a building in your own mind that you build in your mind, and every object in the building, every corridor, every room represents a memory, and it's a way of like organizing all your information into a physical structure that only exists in your head. And we combine that with some very esoteric Tibetan meditative techniques. And this is what Pendergast uses as a way to try to visualize a crime scene or what happened. You know, he has all this information about a crime and how it was committed. He has all the forensic evidence. He has all this information. And then he uses it to create this sort of very intense meditative process where he visualizes exactly how the crime occurred. And it's also
based on how intelligent a person is. For example, Doug's memory palace is an Airstream trailer, and mine is the Palace of Versailles.
Gotcha. In fact, some of your books seem to have a supernatural thread running through them. Have you ever wanted to devote an entire novel to the supernatural?
No, we have not. We've been very strongly encouraged not to do that because we don't want to be pigeonholed as horror novelists. Not that horror novelists have any kind of negative connotations, but it's just that writing mainstream thrillers, you have to write books that sort of maybe seem to sort of skate the edge of supernaturalism, but they have a scientific explanation, and we've always enjoyed teasing the readers to that degree. You know, is there a real monster here? Is there some, you know, kind of strange force at hand? But at the end, we usually, not always, but usually give a scientific, rational explanation.
Okay. What's next for Pendergast and the two of you?
Well, we're working on a new novel. We don't have a title for it yet. But it takes place in Massachusetts, and it opens with Pendergast is sitting at home with his ward, and they're in the evening, and a knock comes at the door, and a man comes in, and he wants to hire Pendergast to solve a crime. His wine cellar has been stolen. Well, Pendergast has no interest in this until he learns that until the fellow says, "Well, thank God they didn't get my case of Chateau de Brackey-Lange." And Pendergast's ears perk up because he's a wine connoisseur. And so he arranges to take the case in return for one bottle of this wine, this extremely valuable, almost unique wine. But when he goes and investigates the cellar where the wine was stolen, he realizes that the theft of the wine cellar was a cover-up for another theft. That walled up in this old house in Massachusetts in the basement, finds a niche, and walled up in this niche had been a man who had been there for at least 100 years, and these people had used the theft of the wine collection as a sort of cover-up to come in, open the niche up, and take the skeleton out. And so Pendergast is wondering, why did they do this, and why this elaborate crime, and that leads him into a truly terrifying situation in this small town in Massachusetts.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.